So we've been doing this event, the Science and the Future event, in conjunction with the Oxford Martin School, who've been very supportive of the event since it started 3 years ago. We choose a different theme every year. So the first time we did the future of life, and last year we did uncertain futures. And when I was thinking what we might do this year, I thought, well, what about doing death? Which seemed like an unlikely topic to choose. But I think my rationale was that this is a literary festival, and it's often claimed by literary types like novelists and poets that death is the major preoccupation of the arts. We have countless examples from the poetry of Keats or almost any novelist you can think of that has this preoccupation with human mortality and how we deal with that evidently shattering knowledge that we are only on this world for a brief space of time. And I thought it would be actually interesting to tackle this subject from the point of view of the science of death and look at it squarely in the face and ask what we know about death, and then go on to think about what the future of death might be. Will it be always with us? Is it, as has again one of these many writers has called it, a necessary end? Nothing more certain, death and taxes, as the phrase we've all heard. Could we actually discuss the possibility that there might be some kind of escape route, some way of getting away from death, and indeed whether that might be a good thing? So we're going to start off this afternoon with the fundamentals. What do we actually mean by death in a scientific sense? And here to discuss that with me on this panel, I'll just mention their names briefly now, but I'm going to introduce them to you a little more fully one by one. We have Professor Francis Ashcroft, Dr. Kevin Fong, and Professor Sunetra Gupta. And I'm going to begin with Fran. Francis Ashcroft is GlaxoSmithKline Professor, she's got a very long title. GlaxoSmithKline Royal Society Research Professor in Oxford University's Department of Physiology, Anatomy and Genetics. She studies mostly the cells in the pancreas that secrete insulin, and her research has made it possible for children born with neonatal diabetes to be treated with a tablet rather than injections. But she's also an author, and last year published, I will borrow her copy of it, her second book for the general public, which is called The Spark of Life. And I should say, Fran's book is really about life, not about death. But obviously, these two things are two sides of a coin, and we can't really have one without the other. So, Fran, welcome. We all think we know what happens when an animal or a human being dies. It's, you know, 1 minute you're alive, and the next you're dead. But you're looking at the individual components that make up a living body. Is that still a fair way of looking at it, if you're thinking of it in terms of the individual cells?
Well, no, it's not really, of course, because although it may seem like you die instantaneously, one moment you're there and the next moment you're not, at the cellular level, it's not like that at all. Death is really a sort of extinction by stages. And there's a because this is a literary festival, I want to mention to you this wonderful Czech poet who is also an immunologist. And he described this beautifully in an essay that he wrote, which is called Shedding Life, which is about the death of a muskrat. His neighbour found a muskrat in Hollab's swimming pool and shot it. And Hollab had to clean it up. And as he was doing this, he was musing about what death actually is. And what he explains is that death is, as an individual, it's not just the stoppage of the heart or the loss of brain function, because the cells continue to survive afterwards. And he writes, the muskrat's inner life signals were probably still flickering, dimming and fading out, instructions from one gland to the liver and from the adrenals to the thyroid and from the thyroid gland to many other sorts of cells and so on and so on. And he has some beautiful phrases because he calls the dying debate of an organism whose trillions of cells coexist thanks to unified information. And because the cells are still alive and the blood cells are trying to repair the damage, he also describes it as the muskrat was still, in a sense, running around the pool in search of itself, which I think is a lovely phrase. Because really, when you think about it, what the shed blood is showing is that there's not one death, but a lot of little deaths of varying degrees and significances. And of course, you know, we know this because it's for this reason that it was possible for the very early experiments that were carried out trying to understand about electrical phenomena in animals and humans and so on, how they actually started, because it was with the demonstration that it was possible to shock the legs of a frog with an electric spark, and they twitched, despite the fact that they were no longer connected to the frog, that showed that animals do produce their own electricity.
So let's just get the explanation out of the way. What is the spark? What is it that keeps a cell alive, that is the difference between a cell being alive and being dead?
Oh, I think that's a very big question. And there are many different types of death, and we can define it in many different ways. But perhaps if we know that the way that we define death is when the electrical activity of the brain ceases, when your brain waves stop. So in one sense, the brain dies when the electrical signals can no longer be generated. So therefore, we have to think about how those electrical signals can be generated. And that's due to a set of... So if you think about it, your brain is generating electrical signals all the time. That's why you can hear and see me now and move your limbs and all this sort of thing. And those electrical signals are down to the activity of a set of proteins which are known as ion channels. And most people have never heard of them, but they're terribly important for everything you do.
And they sit in the membrane that contains the cell.
Yes, so every cell has a membrane around it, and these proteins sit in the membrane. They act as little gated pores that allow ions to move in and out. And those are things like sodium, potassium, salts and things. Sorry.
And they're electrically charged, these things.
So they carry a current, and that gives rise to the electrical signal. And the reason that the ions move is because they're moving from a high concentration to a low concentration. So in one sense, the really crucial thing is to maintain those concentration gradients. And that's done by a little molecular pump known as the sodium pump, which pumps out the sodium ions when they come in. And that means that the concentration gradients can act like a battery to power the electrical signals. And when those concentration gradients run down, then it's rather like when you have a flat battery in your car, you can't actually start it, nothing will happen. So that's when it's curtains for you and I, when those gradients have run down. And the pump requires a lot of energy to keep it going. And so that's what we use, the oxygen that we breathe and the food that we eat to power those pumps. And it's quite extraordinary. About a third of the oxygen that you breathe and half of the food that you eat goes to just power this little tiny pump that's in every single one of your cells. And 10% of the energy you produce is used by the brain. So, you know, this is the extraordinary thing. Thinking is actually energetically really expensive. And death happens when all of this ceases.
Mm. So breathing and eating, which we all know we've got to do in order to stay alive, are really just there in order to keep this battery charged.
Yeah, exactly. And that accounts for who you are, in fact. But of course, there are other sorts of cell death, if you want me to mention those.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, we tend to think of death as being a rather bad thing, but in terms of the body's development, that needn't necessarily be the case.
There's one sort of death. So there are many different sorts of death. One is sort of necrosis, where the cell is damaged and it just gives up. and that's a bad thing because it tends to lead to inflammation and so on, and maybe other injury to the body. But there is a very special type of cell death that's known as programmed cell death or cell suicide, where the cells actually kill themselves. And this is really important. This is a form of death which actually we can't do without, because if this didn't happen, you would end up with webs between your fingers. It's when you have an infection, sometimes this is how the cell kills itself, so that viruses and so on are destroyed in this way. It's also what happens in cancer. Sometimes the cells undergo apoptosis. This is its, you know, it's other name, scientific name. And most importantly of all is that during development, what happens is your brain is built up using apoptosis, because the neurons, the nerve cells, when they first grow, they send out these these
processes.
Processes, yeah. Yes. And as those which actually make contact with the right place will stay there. But those that don't wither away and die by this process of cell suicide.
So it's like it's like pruning a tree in a way.
Yeah,
so you end up with a nice shape that works.
Body sculpting.
Yes.
And so it's vitally important.
And we've talked about cells that die in a living body, but you can also look at it the other way around and think about, I mean, once heard tell of immortal cell lines. So you could have a cell that's still alive when the body that first created it has been long dead. How does that work?
Well, I suppose the most famous case of that is the cells that came from the cancer that Henrietta Lacks had, which are known as HeLa cells and which grow in just about every laboratory.
That's HeLa. It sounds as if it means something that heals, but it's just H-E-L-A and it's short for Henrietta Lacks. That's where the name comes from.
And so those cells can be found in many, many labs, including my own. I mean, the fascinating thing about that is, of course, those cells were taken without her permission, which perhaps is, I don't suppose she ever envisaged that her cells would still be alive. But of course, it's not her. It's cells that came from her. So it's rather a different thing. And I think it's quite interesting to think how much of her, you know, how different is the DNA inside those cells from the cells which were originally taken from the body? Because they will have undergone mutations, they will have, things will have happened to them as a consequence of how they were cultured. We all know that if you take, the scientists in the audience know that if you take some cells and you take them out of the body and you culture them, which you can do, they don't necessarily behave the same over generations of cells. So things happen, they're not the same. I think the other thing that's very interesting, which is along these lines, is when you think of what happens to plants. We all know that plants can propagate vegetatively. So, you know, you've all seen the strawberry runners that come out from your strawberry plants. And so I think it's very interesting to think about, when you have these plants, to what extent are they the same plant that started out? You know, if you have a clone of trees where they're all coming up and the original one dies, are the ones that are left behind, which were part of it, still the same tree or not the same tree? I suspect they're not, but it's a fascinating thing to think whether they are or not.
Mm. So what, I'm just interested in why are we particularly interested in these immortal cells like Henrietta Lacks's cells? What, for a scientist,
why can we use them?
Well yes, what's interesting about them to you?
Well, the reason they're interesting is that we can grow them in the laboratory and we can use them for experiments. So, for example, I can have cells which have been, I mean, not every cell that you take from the body will just continue to grow. Sometimes they have to be immortalized by turning them into cancer cells, which is essentially what they are. And that's sometimes done with viruses. And so they continue to grow. And if you take them from, say, the cells that secrete insulin, I can have an insulin-secreting cell line, so I don't have to kill an animal to get it out, to get them out, and I can study the cells. The problem is that they change, as I've said. So there is a huge problem about the cells that secrete insulin. They don't do so in response to glucose. None of the cell lines do, so none of them are perfect, and they can only be used in a very limited way to tell us how glucose stimulates insulin secretion.
But that's it's opening up an interesting question that I think we're going to discuss more as the afternoon goes on, about the identity of the individual and how that relates to genetic, or doesn't, to genetic identity.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, we all know that identical twins have got the same DNA to begin with, but they sure are different people.
Okay, thanks very much, Fran. And before we move on, I'd just like to ask whether Kevin or Sunetra has got any particular questions they'd like to put to Fran that arise from what she's been talking about.
So, I mean, I don't think I ever really appreciated how difficult it was to get cell cultures on which you can do the research that you're interested in, which is this very important insulin secretion thing, which is responsible for so much disease today, isn't it? So, I mean, you know, insulin-sensitive diabetes, or even things that border on being diabetes, are big contributors to heart disease. So important to research. And yeah, I don't think I just assumed that you would just crack out a bunch of cells and get them to be insulin-sensitive or not. So I just tell me how you go about that then.
So we do use cell lines if we need to produce lots of protein. But if we really want to understand what's going on, then we have to take a mouse, kill the mouse, and isolate the cells. Very occasionally, people donate their bodies for research, and when they die, their bodies, as I've said already, and perhaps I haven't said this, but of course, when you die, the rest of your body doesn't die, which is why we can take hearts out and use it for transplant, and why we can also take the cells from the pancreas from somebody who's died, but whose cells are kept alive by the fact that they're given oxygen to breathe. And so we can study those too. But it happens rather rarely, and you certainly can't do that as a basis for scientific experiments. What you need to do is to have is to work on the animals that you can have, every week, and then make sure that everything that you've learned from the animals holds in humans when you're lucky enough to get the human tissues. And diabetics, well, that's very rare. Sunetra.
So, like you, Georgina, I'm fascinated by the notion of identity and how it's anchored to not just genetics, to how the integrity of the body actually confers identity, because, not just our genes, but in fact the molecules that we're made of, they will continue to exist. And to what degree do we take comfort in the existence of certain components that constitute us? Some of them are going to exist for a very, very long time, possibly until the end of the universe. And then there are the cells, which may be immortalized. And then there are the organs. And I wonder sometimes how a mother feels about her child's heart beating in another body. To what degree do we invest parts of us which are going to carry on, which are not ourselves, with a sense of it being part of us? Because at the end of the day, nothing is us except the whole of us. And I think that's very interesting when it comes to the layers of death that you mention and our genetic identities and the fact of watching twins who are identical at the level that we would
be
want
so
to.
Different.
We ourselves think, this is me, this is my genetic code. You can even hang it up on the wall now and say, that's me. But in fact, of course, the twins instantly give a lie to that. So.
But it is very interesting, isn't it, how actually things go down the generations. There's that wonderful poem by Thomas Hardy goes something like, "This is the family face, flesh perishes, I live on, projecting trait and trace through," I haven't got the words right, but basically he calls it the immortal thing in man that heeds no call to die. And 50 years before the discovery of DNA, he was talking about genetics. And it's absolutely fascinating to me. We can all see it in our children, in our siblings, and so on. But to go back to what you said before, I think it would be rather wonderful if when I died, I could give life to somebody else. So I certainly have a donor card, because I think that would be a wonderful gift.
But perhaps not necessarily because it's a continuation of you.
No,
because it's just an act of giving.
Just because it's a present.
So, which is different from the sort of hubristic almost
notion. No, I think when I die,
I will continue through.
Yeah, no, I don't. Mm-hmm. I stop. Exactly. I only live on in things like this and my scientific work.
Also, but I think one ought to also, the notion of living on through your children is also a little bit complicated. I've got a funny story there, which is that one of my cousins used to work in, as a doctor to in Bombay, and he had a Bollywood actress or actor's son as his patient, and the Bollywood actor came in and he said, "I want to donate blood," because the son needed blood, and he said, "No, you can't. We'll have to check whether you can." And he said, "You mean I can't give blood to my own son?"
Yes.
And there's this sense of that you're what you leave behind is something that is so essentially you. And I think actually it's more we would be better to think of just giving and stopping rather than
of course
trying to perpetuate ourselves.
Well, let's move on now to Kevin. I mean, the way I've kind of thought of this session is that Fran is talking to us about has talked to us about what happens at the level of cells. Kevin is talking about us as individuals, and when we come to Sunetra, she's going to be looking much more broadly about populations and how we cope with disease. So Kevin Fong is an anaesthetist at a University College Hospital, specialising in intensive care medicine, but he leads at least a double life. We spoke on the phone the other night, and I think I worked out that he's got three day jobs. It's difficult to say what the day job is, but he's certainly working at the absolute frontiers of keeping people dead and alive in hospital part of the time. But he's also collaborating with NASA on the whole question of how you keep people alive when you send them out into space. And the third strand of his existence is in a popularizer, somebody who brings the complexities of medicine and science to a general audience through a number of television programs that he's presented, and now through his new book, which he might like to wave at you there, which is called Extremes, Life, Death, and the Limits of the Human Body. So, Kevin, what's the most extreme example you've come across of somebody going through an experience which, to all intents and purposes, is terminal, should not have survived, and yet living to tell the tale?
And in many ways, I'm at the other end of the spectrum to Fran. You know, I'm sort of the Philistine end user of the whole biology of this. And in my work as an intensive care doctor, so anaesthetists and intensivists, you know, what we do is we fly people's physiology, especially when it's in trouble, you know. And it is a bit like being a pilot, except for the plane's on fire and doesn't have enough fuel, and you've got to find a way to fix that before you land. But there are lots of, you know, in practice, there have been enough times when I have thought, we're never getting out of this. You know, this patient is not going to survive, and have been utterly surprised. I mean, there are dozens of times, and in fact, the measure of how experienced you are as a doctor is how certain you are about the outcome of a thing. Because the more you go on, the more you realise that you know, sometimes remarkable stories of survival arise. But there's one out there that's almost sort of mythological for us in medicine that we all kind of know. When you talk to doctors, they kind of have heard the story, and it's the story of a woman called Anna Bagenholm. I was lucky enough to meet, actually, when we were filming a Horizon documentary, but I knew the story already. And she is a remarkable woman who's 29 years old when she had her accident. She had an accident while she was skiing in the Arctic Circle. She's Norwegian. She was skiing in the mountains in North Norway. Comes down a ridge and catches an edge. She's with two other junior doctors and falls headlong onto a thick sheet of ice covering a fast-running stream, falls through a hole in that ice and gets wedged in an air pocket between the ice and the water, and her friends ski down to her, can't pull her out. And so she's there with her clothes being drenched and slowly freezing to death. And they know that. None of the three of them can be in any doubt what the consequence is going to be if they can't get her out, but they can't get her out. So they call for help. They call for ski patrol on the other side of the mountain are going to be an hour away. They call for the helicopter, but the helicopter is over an hour away. It's 200 miles away at its base in Tromsø. And she, after about 30 minutes of struggling desperately, goes limp and her heart stops beating. The ski patrol arrive, they have a substantial shovel and they break the ice, they get her out. But by this time she has no pulse and she is blue. And the rescuer at the time says, you know, all I thought we could achieve here was retrieving the body of a dead friend. Nevertheless, they continue with the resuscitation. They start resuscitating her. And then the helicopter arrives. Now, the helicopter hovers overhead, and they tow her up onto the vehicle, and they continue the resuscitation. And the problem is there are so many strands of the story that are remarkable. But I've worked on helicopters before. They are not easy places to work with a patient. And to resuscitate somebody on one is nearly impossible. It's nearly impossible to do that. But they do it for another hour of flying time. They fly to Tromsø. When they arrive at the hospital, she has had no pulse of her own for nearly 2 hours. Now, to put that into context, when I'm in A&E and we get the call and the red phone goes off and we expect to receive a victim of cardiac arrest, the first thing we ask very often is, what's the downtime? And by that we mean, what's the time since the heart last beat on its own? And if that number is given at any more than about 30 minutes, we think, that our chances of getting a meaningful someone back with an independent life of which they can live with some meaning is almost nil. In fact, there's a story today I just saw about some... So they think it's a remarkable story because a 63-year-old woman has survived a 45-minute cardiac arrest. This woman I'm talking about has been down for 2 hours at this point. And in any situation where I've seen a downtime, even a significant fraction of that, we stop, we don't bother. But they continue, and they continue for two reasons. One is that this is their friend, and stopping when it's someone you know is nearly impossible. Secondly, it's because they hope that the cold has killed, that the cold that has stopped her heart may also have done something else. It may have protected her brain. What Fran was alluding to before was these cellular processes whose arrest leads eventually to death may have been put into slow motion by the extreme cold. Now, her core temperature when she arrives, well, your core temperatures now, of course, as I'm sure you all know, is about 37 degrees plus or minus about 0.2 degrees. It's very carefully regulated. Plus 1 or 2 degrees in that, you'll feel pretty unwell. You know, plus 1 for men, plus 2 for women. You'll feel pretty unwell and febrile at home. And 2 degrees lower, and you're considered pretty hypothermic, 35 degrees. So you're considered hypothermic at 35 degrees. Her core temperature is 13.7 degrees when she arrives.
Did they keep her cold when they were in the helicopter?
So it's simple physics. You just don't need to, because you're mostly made of water. Mm-hmm. She's 70, 65 odd kilograms of water. It takes 4,200 joules to raise each kilogram of water by 1 degree. And so, you know, you'd have to boil mini kettles of water to get her warm. They get her to the hospital, 2 hours of no heartbeat, and they rewarm her. They don't take her to the resuscitation bay. They take her to surgery, and they put her on a bypass circuit, a heart-lung machine that you do open-heart surgery in. They effectively remove her body and warm it up. So the problem is rewarming her, and they rewarm her really quickly. 3 hours after her heart first stopped, the heart starts to beat again. Remarkable. But you're not out of the woods, because then you think, well, has the brain been starved of oxygen for long enough that the thing that is essentially her is still irretrievably damaged? And that's what I would expect in that situation. I would certainly expect someone to have severe neurological injury. But she survived. Not only did she survive, she turns up to a case conference about her own case 6 months later to tell everyone how great everyone did. She specialises as a radiologist in the hospital to save her life. She is remarkable. I brought her to the Royal Society of Medicine to lecture to other doctors about it, because for us, there's no science in this, it's one person. But it redefines our expectations of survival, or what we think is survivable. And
so what do you think the lessons were from that for people who work in emergency medicine?
Well, I think it's simply that actually, you know, we don't know. As an intensive care physician, basically what happens is someone... you pick up the phone and someone says, please come quickly, and you run down to some ward, and you've got someone who is in extremis. By definition, they've called you. And the lessons for us are that, you know, it is often worth persisting longer than you think. You don't know at that moment what's going to happen.
What are the main things that you're up against in the intensive care situation?
Well, you are up against sort of the extended stuff that we talk. You know, life is a property distributed across the trillions and trillions of cells of your body, and when we're called to see a patient, some of the processes that support that distributed life have started to shut down. And so what you do in intensive care is effectively organ support. So you are this thing to buy time for the patients, in the hope that something will change. Either their physiology will change because the disease will abate, or someone can make some intervention.
What, sorry?
So what you're hoping, either the disease itself will abate, or that someone can intervene. Mm. So I think the lessons that we learn really is that you just need to stay in, and you know, you can't judge a situation just on first seeings, I think. Mm. And certainly no responsible intensive care clinician would do that. Mm.
Yeah. I want to switch now to your interest in space, because this is, I mean, we have this determination to do something that we're really not evolved to do, which is to travel out and discover, travel out into space and possibly even settle on other planets. From a medical point of view, that must seem foolish.
So, you know, I always felt guilty about this double life. I started off life as an astrophysicist. I studied astrophysics at UCL because the university college applications handbook is alphabetically arranged. I was pretty good at maths, and that was it. That's all. And somewhere along that journey, actually, and I really loved it. It was a real great privilege to study something for the sake of studying, knowledge for the sake of knowledge. I would never regret having done that. But there was part of me that felt, oh, it was time to grow up and do something more practical. And for lots of reasons, one chance encounter with Maurice Wilkins, who's the Nobel laureate for discovery of the double helix structure of DNA, along with Crick and Watson, kind of led me to medicine. And I thought, that was it. You're done. You're going to be a GP and have sheep and live in the West Country. But actually, I got a chance to go to NASA and indulge this sort of boyhood fantasy of going to space and things. And so while I was a junior doctor, in parallel, I used to get on a plane on my holidays. I'd go to Houston and you'd come off a shift where you'd have been dealing with these cases that we've been talking about, and you'd go and sit in a room and have straight-faced conversations about blasting off and going to Mars. And I felt really quite guilty about that. And in fact, that's a lot of what the book's about, is sort of trying to reconcile those two parts of my life. But in the end, I think they are essentially the same thing, because the 20th century was this remarkable century, and I think I came, in exploring that through the book, in which our expectations of survival just transformed beyond all recognition, and in a way that happened so quickly that we just don't really appreciate it. You go out today, you look left instead of right, you get smacked by a lorry, and here in Oxford, there's a good chance a helicopter will drop out of the sky, someone in a fluorescent jumpsuit will walk out, scoop you into the back of it, fly you to somewhere, and you have an outside chance of surviving that. And that is unknown maybe 25 years ago. But all of that, the century that does that to you in medicine, that advances medicine to the point where your expectations of survival are so outrageous, is the same century in which our physical exploration advances in the same way. You go from 100 years ago, we're having this chat and we're talking about the hazards posed by the South Pole. And now we're talking about the hazards posed by an object that is 400 million miles away and requires a vehicle that has the explosive capacity of a small atomic weapon to get there. And both of those destinations are achieved in medicine and exploration in the same way, and that is by wrapping the human body, the frail physiology that we have, because it is really frail. We're really rubbish. Plus or minus 1 degree north or south of 37 degrees, 8 kilometres vertically onto the mountains, and about 40 metres that way, breathing air. You're done. Done. The only way that you advance in medicine and exploration in that way is to wrap concentric layers of protection around you through technology. That's what we do. These heroic surgeries that we do didn't wait for a surgeon that was skillful enough or arrogant enough to do them, because history had plenty of those. It waited for us to be able to protect the body from the assault of the surgery with antibiotics, with blood transfusions, with intensive care and anesthesia to launch those assaults. We didn't get into space through being, ran off fine, super tough. We did it by wrapping bubbles of life support around ourselves and cramming them into vehicles and firing those through the canopy. So it's all about our extended survival is really now all about technology and wrapping ourselves in technology to project ourselves forwards. And I think that's where I got to with the book in the end, that I felt okay about going away and doing spacemen and coming back and doing intensive care, because I think it's all exploration. I mean, I think what I've... it's obvious that if you're going to continue to explore, you must survive. But I think if the 20th century tells us anything, it tells us that slightly less intuitive thing, which is that if you want to continue as a species to improve your survivorship, you must explore. You must explore in any way that you can, and in ways that aren't obvious to you initially, or of which the benefits aren't going to be obvious. Otherwise you're done.
That's great. I think it's going to lead us very nicely into what Sunetra's going to be talking about. But before we do that, can I just ask if Fran and Sunetra have anything they want to, any comment they'd like to make on Kevin's presentation?
Well, I was actually thinking of Fran's earlier book, which maybe I can put in a plug for, which is about life in the extremes, but where the extremes are sort of tested by life itself rather than by wrapping life up. And I just wondered what the relationship was between the kind of extreme that Kevin, you just talked about.
Actually, there's a question I was going to follow
through
that.
Sorry.
I'm just summarising a little bit what you're just saying. You just said that we're rubbish as humans. But actually, I bristle slightly at that because I think our resilience is quite remarkable. And I just wonder which side you come down on, given your exposure, as to how resilient we are versus
when I'm at work in the hospitals in the middle of the night looking at patients, you are ceaselessly impressed at how resilient people are at the edges. So at the edge of the envelope that supports human life, we are phenomenally resilient. We will do everything to try and keep going, you know, and you've got these really well-developed mechanisms to try and give you every last opportunity right up until the last moment. You know, this process of the kick in automatically to try and preserve you. And when you're looking at it as a physician playing at the edges at that, trying to get people into advantage, trying to bring them back from that, you know, you are ceaselessly amazed at how robust we are within that envelope. But when I go back to my ideas of the limits of the physical universe, you know, it is absurd. It is absurdly narrow, that. So as I say, so the summit of Everest is almost certainly the high altitude limit for human life breathing air. There's a guy called Habler who climbed it the first time without supplementary oxygen, I think it was in the 80s. He writes this essay, this thing that he wrote at the summit of what it felt like to be there, and it's, you know, it is the poem of a man with a brain dying of oxygen starvation. It's, you know, he said, I was a single floating lung floating along the clouds. I mean, you know, he's going to float along the clouds forever if he stays there. And that's 8.8 kilometres that way. That's nothing. It's nothing.
But it's true, isn't it? Because what you say about surrounding ourselves with protective environments, every time you fly in an aeroplane, you're at 35,000 feet, it's freezing cold out there. You wouldn't survive if the windows broke open. And actually, if you were to go out today when it's pretty cold outside, if you didn't have houses and fires and good clothes and all the rest of it, you might very well suffer from exposure.
Utterly blasé. And so that there's a hilarious thing. Next time you get on a plane, when they do the safety thing that you always ignore, you're at the in-flight magazine trying to work out what movie you're going to watch. You think, and they sort of glitz through this thing in a comedically light-hearted way. Here's the life jacket if we stack into the water. This is the little oxygen mask you need if we depressurize. And it's hilarious because, you know, to a scientist, if you stop to think about why they're telling you those things, it's pretty alarming. If you lose a window at altitude in the brain, 35,000 feet, your time of useful consciousness in that vehicle is about 30 seconds. Okay? Which is why they tell you that thing of put your mask on before your recalcitrant toddler. Because by the time you've fought little Johnny off, you're going to be... he doesn't care, you don't care, and it's all going to go very badly. So, you know, but we do all these things. We're in these ridiculous environments in medicine, and you go on holiday, you get into an airliner, you fly at a fraction of the speed of sound at 35,000 feet, and you moan about the legroom. You know, there's a lot more to moan about in that environment.
Okay, thanks very much, Kevin. And we're turning now to Sunetra. Sunetra Gupta is Professor of Theoretical Epidemiology in the Department of Zoology at Oxford and a member of the Oxford Martin School Programme on vaccines. She works on the evolutionary ecology of infectious diseases such as malaria, bacterial meningitis, and influenza. But she's also the author of 5 novels. And I thought it would be very nice to have her here today, harking back to what I said earlier about novelists' preoccupation with the transience of human life. She's just completed an e-book on pandemics. She's currently working on a book about narrative in science and literature and a series of books books for children on women scientists. So, Sunetra, how big a threat is infectious disease and what are we doing to contain that threat?
Well, it depends on where you live. So here, we're very unlikely now to die of infectious disease, but that wasn't the case. Even 100 years ago. So infectious disease now occupies this sort of rather strange position where there are many people still dying of infectious diseases, but those of us with the means to do anything about it aren't. So it calls for this appreciation of that particular fact. However, I like Steve Jones has a nice sort of way of describing our history as having gone from one where we could expect to die mainly of some kind of disaster to a long period where we could expect to die of disease, and Now we mainly have to contend with the decay. The muddy vestiture of decay, as Shakespeare would put it. So I think that that's created an interesting sort of vacuum for us, the lack of disease. So, I mean, death is still with us, so I have come here with some wonderful quotes from poets about death. We won't bring Keats into it again, but Wallace Stevens, for instance, in Sunday Morning says, "Death is the mother of beauty. Hence from her alone shall come fulfillment to our dreams and to our desires." So death obviously occupies a very important position, not just in opposition to life, but just its nuances and how it sort of diffracts through life. But having now moved death to a position where it is death through decay rather than death through disease, I think does leave a kind of vacuum for us. And we've been trying, I think, personally, to fill that vacuum with a new fear of disease, because death through disease, I think, has a sort of redemptive element to it. And that's another, where's my favorite Camus quote from The Plague. This is the last, the closing lines of The Plague mentions that the plague bacillus never dies. And this isn't strictly true, that the plague bacillus does die. But what he says is it never dies or disappears for good. It can lie dormant for years and years in furniture and linen chests. It bides its time in bedrooms, cellars, trunks, and bookshelves. And perhaps the day would come again when, for the bane and enlightenment of men, it would rouse up its rats and send them forth to die in a happy city. So this issue of bane and enlightenment that we attach to disease, infectious disease, to a calamity, after all, that sort of death at a mass level through infectious disease isn't something we can realize in the period of decay. And I think there is a part of us that misses it, because so much of the literature we receive and dwell in is still informed by either that calamitous death or the death that we had to live with, of our children dying, of ourselves dying in childbirth, the death in the pre-antibiotic era. So that's where we, you know, our collective unconscious or conscious, whatever you want to call it, that's where our culture, I think, our international cultures are located still, in that kind of consciousness. So I think there's a very interesting position that's developed out of drawing sustenance, emotional sustenance, from that kind of literature, and yet existing in a time when, no, we're not going, hopefully, you know, our children aren't going to die of infectious disease, we don't risk dying childbirth. And I rather fear that some of our response to the threat of a pandemic is coloured by that.
So are you saying we shouldn't be worried about pandemics? Because we've had SARS, we've had bird flu, and each time there seems to be, I mean, you know, WHO declared a pandemic.
No.
And the you know, work is being done to organise surveillance for these pandemics, and we're constantly reminded of the 1918 flu pandemic, which killed hundreds of millions of people.
50 million.
50 million people, but hundreds of millions were infected. Mm. And I mean, are we really at a stage where we don't need to worry about that possibility?
No, I think we'll never be at a stage where we don't need to worry about it. The issue is, how much should we worry about it, and what should we do about it? Should we consider this? Should we worry about it? What kind of models of previous pandemics should we base our worries upon? Should we be thinking about 1918 as a model for what might happen next? Should we be thinking about the plague? What do we actually draw our models from? When we think about the plague, our minds fill with visions of these sort of Genoese galleons sailing in with rats from the Far East. We think of the Silk Road, and many of our fears of disease do locate in a rather kind of obvious and boring way into Well, they do. They're coterminous with our fear of the other.
The other, the foreign.
The
yes.
foreign.
That was very true with the AIDS epidemic too, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes, exactly mm-hmm. like that. It came from Africa.
It came from Africa. It jumped from monkeys. What were they doing anyway with those monkeys? There's a sort of horrendous sort of suspicion that surrounds all of that. And that's also led to an idea that perhaps if we go and track down every single virus that there is, or it's usually viruses people think about, that perhaps we'll be able to anticipate when they might jump across. So this hunt it down and kill it mentality that has arisen, I think, derives in a somewhat superficial way from a notion, from the, well, from our previous experience of pandemics.
So how would you say we should, what's the alternative view that we should have? I mean, well, one thing that's clear is that we're still here. There have been infectious pathogens probably as long as people have been around, and obviously animals have been going a lot longer, and there are infectious pathogens that affect them, and yet we're still here. They haven't wiped us out. How is that balance maintained, and is that something that we should...
I think balance is the right word. Yeah. So of course, infectious disease is the product of an association between two species. And when they first encounter each other, it can have very unfortunate consequences for two reasons. The host species has no immunity at all. No immunity to infection, no immunity to disease, no immunity to severe disease, which are all slightly different things. When a pathogen comes into a sort of virgin soil-like situation, it can really cause massive death, which is what happened with the plague. And certainly, we know the history books are filled with anecdotes anyway of smallpox and measles killing people in the New World. So we know that when a disease arrives into an entirely susceptible population, there will be a big epidemic, at least. And then it's sort of the natural course of an infectious disease is that it will then bounce around a bit and then settle down and achieve an equilibrium. It can still kill a lot of people. Malaria is perhaps in that sort of equilibrium state. It's still killing around 1 million kids a year. So I suppose part of my mission statement is that there are many diseases which have reached an equilibrium, but it's not an easy equilibrium. And perhaps we should just be a bit careful about how much energy we allocate to dealing with the potential threat of disease.
Well, except for, and just to advocate for my public health mates, I think it's fair enough not to be too worried about pandemics, but if you're not worried about them, you probably shouldn't worry about very much at all. Because, because as a citizen of the world, infectious disease is still the thing that's likely to kill you above all.
Yes, but not in pandemic form. At the moment.
No, at the moment, but it's difficult to know, isn't it?
No, the person, it might kill us sitting here who don't normally die. It's the people who are not dying of malaria and TB who might die of a pandemic disease.
Yeah, no, that's true. Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that we shouldn't be worrying about
it. Yeah. What I wanted to ask is that you talked about an equilibrium state. So what changes? Is it the pathogen that changes, or is it us that changes to enable that equilibrium to be reached?
To be reached? Well, yes. On a short-ish time scale, or when I say short-ish, I mean not on an evolutionary time scale, it's simply that the number of people who have already experienced the disease or have some level of immunity to it reaches a level where...
So it's us that changes it.
We change in terms of acquiring immunity, but on the longer term, we can actually be selected to have genes that give some sort of resistance to disease. Some of these genes are often deleterious, like sickle cell anemia, which can protect against death from malaria and has risen to high frequencies in Africa for that reason.
Isn't it also the case that sometimes the bacteria or the viruses either learn to live with us? Because after all, if you kill your host, it's not the ideal thing. And isn't it also the case that some viruses now actually can be found incorporated within our own DNA?
Yes. Most of us is virus.
Yes, and bacteria, and also that there are bacteria which live very happily with us.
So most of the bacteria that we, most of our associations, microorganisms, are happy ones, or at least commensal in the sense that nobody suffers. So so disease is an unusual outcome, and it's certainly not in the interest of the pathogen to kill you, and the pathogen population will also evolve to become not completely avirulent, as was the dogma before, but to achieve a level of optimal virulence where it maximizes its transmission. So sometimes virulence itself, the ability to cause disease, enables transmission. So the classic example is of the myxoma virus, which was released in Australia.
To control rabbits. 50s.
Yes, to control the rabbits. And the myxoma virus that was released was a virus that was obtained, so this is a sort of rabbit pox, and it was obtained from the New World, where it had evolved to become very avirulent to the rabbits, New World rabbits, but was very virulent to the Old World rabbits, which were the ones that were causing, creating a problem, massacring the vegetation of Australia. But what was observed is two things, that the rabbits became a bit more resistant, and the pox virus became less virulent. But it never became completely avirulent, and this is because when the rabbit gets myxomatosis, it gets sores, and the spread of the virus is enabled by those sores. But then, so what the optimal state for the virus is to be able to cause some sores, but not to kill the rabbit. So that's kind of where it heads. So there are lots of interesting, the whole dynamic, this is partly from an intellectual point of view, this is why I study infectious disease, it's because it's a fascinating ecological system, and some of the best examples of evolution in action can be found in infectious disease systems.
So what sort of lessons are there for us? I mean, it could be argued that, well, it often is argued, as you alluded earlier, that disease comes about because of people travelling from one country to another. So should we stop doing that? Should we keep ourselves in...
Well, the other side of that coin is that people coming in from... So if we all sort of mix... if we don't have these isolated pockets where people don't travel to, as was the case before, let's say, 1918, we will also prevent the build-up of virgin soil. So, yes, we have diseases coming in, but those diseases are also conferring some kind of immunity, and a much ignored part of immunity is the immunity that's not specific to a particular strain or a particular species even of a pathogen, but that extends a little bit beyond that to at least take the edge off infection or disease by a related organism.
So, so we develop a repertoire of protection,
yes,
really, by having more and more exposure to more different kinds of pathogens.
Yes. I mean, I'm not trying to downplay the risk of, a virus that we've never seen arriving suddenly because Gwyneth Paltrow shook hands with the chef.
But after the first half of that film is a pretty close reenactment of SARS 2003.
I think it's very good.
Isn't it?
It's really good. It's excellent. And that's
sorry,
contagion.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Sorry.
But of course, so that does exist as a threat, but we have to, I think, keep it in perspective.
And I think we've got time for a couple of questions.
I'd like to ask why it is. Have you any idea why we feel so afraid of pandemics and infectious diseases when we don't seem to be as afraid of something like diabetes, which affects 350 million of us, and where we can actually do something about it, but we just eat ourselves into the grave.
Quite.
So why is it we're afraid of something like that and not
which
afraid?
Is quite a low risk compared to, as you say, developing diabetes or someone smashing a window in that plane, for that matter.
So I
just think there is a threat, but I think it is disproportionate at the moment.
But why should people be so much more afraid of that? Why are we all so afraid?
Because it has this wonderful narrative, which has been exploited, of course, in a good way, by contagion. You know, the theatre of disease.
So then maybe we need to have a few more narratives about obesity.
Exactly.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it part of it? The fear is because we feel we have no control over the infection that's out there somewhere, deadly miasmas, as were talked about in the earlier centuries, whereas our diet is something we feel we're totally in control of. We may eat the wrong things, but at least it's our choice.
I think, yes, I think the part of the... When HIV came in, when AIDS came in, there was widespread fear and confusion. But then part of the reason that sort of abated, I think, is because we feel we can do something about it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're both right. I think illusion of control was a great thing. I think that the ingredients for infectious disease over history, and you have to remember, that start of the 20th century, UK life expectancy for a man is 45 years, for a woman it's 50, and that's because a third of all deaths are occurring in children under the age of five, mostly from infectious disease. And so that whole thing of uncontrollable death in youth is a very evocative thing. I think that's probably...
Also, you know, just sort of melting away slowly from consumption.
Yeah, and that's
true.
There's
the romantic element of disease as well. So, and then there's this redemptive quality of... So it's all sort of entangled. Our emotional response to death from infectious disease is very multifaceted and has roots.
Well, it might come back again if we don't get more antibiotics.
I think that's what to worry about. That's what
problem.
To really worry about is when we pressure pathogens to do something that, that they don't normally like to
we
do.
We need another Flory.
We do.
Great Oxford story.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and I'd really like our audience to have a chance to say a few words. So we have, do we have two? Yes, we have two roving microphones, which I'd be grateful if you'd use, because it makes it easier for everybody else to hear, and we are also being filmed, and so it'll make sure your voice comes out on the soundtrack. So who would like to kick off with a question for any of our panel? You have a lady there.
Hi there. Thank you all very much. Very interesting talk. Just trying to pull together the theme of the three speakers. I think the comment that we used to be most at risk of dying from disaster, then it was disease, now it's decay. I think one of the reasons for that is, as Kevin was saying, how the technology has developed and we've kind of seen, oh, this is a big threat and therefore we'll apply our human ingenuity to fix it. How are we doing on dealing with decay, which is perhaps a question for Fran.
Well, I think we'll put the question to all of them, Fran, but you've been singled out.
I've been singled out. Well, I think it rather depends what you mean by decay. If you just mean aging, I think that certainly you only have to look at people today and compare them to what the same age person looked like 20, 30 years ago to realise that actually we are doing a bit better on aging. I don't know how or why we are. I think it's just that we're taking more care of ourselves and we're not so, you know, we have lots of excellent medicine that helps us along the line. So yes, I think we are. When we come down to the what's happening in aging at the cellular level, that's an absolutely fascinating story. And we are actually now have come to recognize that at least at the in many animals, this is something which is programmed into them. So, and fascinatingly for me, quite a bit of it seems to be involved with the pathway by which insulin has its action. So certainly genetic defects, you know, mutations in those pathways in worms and flies and things like that leads to a twofold increase in life expectancy. Whether we can ever see that in humans, I don't know. But as you will know, I'm sure, there has been a lot of hype around in the last few years about the fact that those pathways are also the same sort of pathways that in worms and flies are involved in calorie restriction, i.e., because we know that if you fast just about every animal that we know of and you keep them on a third less calories than they would normally have, they live for longer, including monkeys, and they're healthier for longer. So that has led to the speculation that the same might be true for humans, that if you eat at the third level, and there are people who are doing this at the moment, as you probably know. The scientific evidence is not yet there, I would say. The only thing that you can do is you can look at populations where they don't eat much, like in certain
you know, in the island of Okinawa in Japan, where they do eat less and they live longer. But at the same time, you can also say, yes, well, they're probably all genetically related, maybe due to the fact that they take a lot more exercise as well as eat less. And so the evidence is not there yet, but it certainly is in animals.
Kevin,
but
did you
nobody
have something
wants to starve.
Well, it's that thing, that theme of decay, isn't it? And I think taking up in the theme of things that we have not irrational, but perhaps an overblown fear of, is decay. You're talking about aging, and the two are seen as synonymous. But there's a few things to say about that. One is that I think that what we've done in the 20th century has opened up many new continents to exploration. Arguably, the continent of old age is now, for the first time, at the end of the 20th century and the start of the 21st, available to most inhabitants of developed countries in a way that it never was before in history. It's remarkable when you look at life expectancy through history, how unchanged it is until the advent of our ability to take on microorganisms until now.
I'm not sure I totally agree with that, if I may be so bold, because I think that the longest age that people can live to has actually not changed much.
Yes, yes.
It's just that more and more people are making it to that
Yes,
age.
But that's kind of what I mean. So formally, right, life expectancy okay. is the number of years one can expect at point of birth, isn't it? And,
yes.
And the truth is that as the fraction of population to whom that adventure is open, it's open to nearly all of us in developed countries.
So 3 score years and 10 is pretty conservative as a life expectancy.
Yeah, well, so for a boy or girl born in the UK today, better than 1 in 4 chance of making their 100th birthday. So in terms of, you know, in the same way that air travel is now available to all easily, so is the continent of old age. And we see that with great fear because, you know, you see it's synonymous with dementia, but dementia is actually into your 9th decade is still the exception rather than the rule. You wouldn't think so from the way the discussion goes. The second thing is to say is there is this idea of a good and a bad death. This idea, you know, and doesn't matter how clever anyone is with pills, antibiotics or anything, they will never invent the pill that allows you to live to 101, be playing tennis on the lawn one day and then you spontaneously combust the next day and painlessly. That won't happen. If you want to extend the number of years of quality life you have, you're going to have to extend the number of years of life you have. And that's what we see in all the clinical models. The longer you live, the greater the number of quality years of life you live. Now, that's not to say that the neurodegenerative diseases, those of dementia, etc., aren't something really profound and difficult to address. But I don't know that that continent should hold as much fear as it really does for us. In the same way, you know, that you say that pandemics shouldn't hold as much fear, I agree, actually. But it's something for, you know, that I think I've seen. Yeah, my friend runs a dementia clinic. He's a neurologist in Sheffield, and he said he spends almost as much time reassuring people that they don't have dementia in that clinic than he does treating people who do.
We've all got problems with our memories. Let's take another question. Yes, gentleman here.
I'd just like to ask, you know, what role does food play and how we treat food in life expectancy? Like we pasteurise our milk. I asked Carlo Petrini the other day and he said it destroys the soul of food. So, and we do so much with food. We change it in 1,000 different ways. We call horse meat beef, and we do all kinds of things. So, just interesting.
Sinetra, have you got? Would you like to just comment on how much cleaner our food is than it was
okay.
once?
Yes. Of course, we learnt to get rid of the infectious diseases. I think that's generally a good thing. I suppose being at the same time the sort of unusual practices that we engage in did also lead to the development of BSE in cows. So I don't know about taking the soul out of milk by pasteurizing it. I think one could be, again, but I think it's the same thing though in terms of being cautious but not over cautious. So you don't want to go and drink some milk that's come out of the udders of a cow with TB, but at the same time, you know, you can risk having unpasteurized cheese some of the time. And then I guess that harkens back to the previous issue. Do we really want to starve ourselves to live longer? I mean, I think with all of these things, there's a notion of risk that has to be put in perspective. And perhaps this sort of over-sanitization, which then actually results in a lack of exposure to harmless, relatively harmless bugs, which would then protect you against more harmful bugs, is an issue which many people in the infectious disease arena are grappling with. There's a notion that asthma, for example, might be on the increase because we don't expose our immune systems to the right kinds of things at the right stages. So there is, you know, essentially there are all these, the systems are very complex and we don't really understand them. All we understand now is that they interact in very, very complicated ways. I mean, from infectious disease systems to the notion of identity. I mean, various things that we've discussed here. I think if there's one theme that comes out of it is that they're all made of complicated interacting elements. And keep having a sense of the whole picture is very difficult. But what's important is not to focus on one element of it and get obsessed with that and let it overwhelm.
I think your from vision. My point of view, I would say moderation in all things. So, you know, it really is the case that you shouldn't eat too much. That's the huge problem that we have at the moment in society at all levels. And if you look at the health of people just after the Second World War, many of them were much healthier than we are now. In terms, you know, not if we exclude infectious disease, etc. But
that's because of the effects of rationing. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because the people ate a decent diet. And it's absolutely fascinating. I've got some wonderful graphs which show that the incidence of type 2 diabetes, you know, before the Second World War was like this, during the war it was like this, and then it trails off and then it starts again. And another fascinating thing is that during the Bosnian War recently, in Slovenia, they thought that they might run out of insulin. In fact, what they found was that people were coming to hospital with hypoglycemic attacks because they'd taken too much insulin, and that was because they'd lost weight and because they weren't eating as much, because they didn't have the food. So they didn't have a problem with insulin at all. They had quite the opposite to what they were expecting. So I seriously think that, you know, the government's got to do something about it. Somehow or other, we have to help the people of the future not get all these diseases that result from obesity. That's more important than, I think, than, you know, exactly what we're eating.
How would they do that?
Well, I think that's a huge difficulty. So one of it, I mean, we all know what we're supposed to eat, don't we? We know this, and yet we don't do it. And so I think it's going to have to, in the end, be legislation. And I'm afraid that's going to be very, very, very difficult.
Does it mean reining in people who sell you really delicious but rather sugar and fat-laden foods?
I think it means putting a tax on it.
A tax, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Sugar tax.
But that's where it is.
I'd just really like to ask the audience, I mean, I think this distinction that Sinetra made first between, I think it was Sinetra, who talked about disaster and then
Steve
disease.
Steve Jones, oh, I feel like.
Yes, I know. Well, okay, we'll thank Steve Jones for it. But in terms of the relative fear of those things, does anybody want to comment on when they think about their own lives? Are they most afraid of dying because of disaster, of disease or of decay? Which do you think is most threatening to us? Yes, lady at the back there. Can you just wait till you get the microphone? It's on its way.
I think they, depending on what your activities are, they, you know, you might choose to go, you know, to the Arctic Circle, and then disaster is possibly what will befall you. But I don't think one is more threatening than the other. But in ways of dying, but certainly decay is the most challenging one because it is possibly the very slowest way of dying, and also the one where you but you have to live with that decay the longest. You know, once you are in a disaster, that's pretty quick, and it depends on the infection, can also be pretty quick in any way. Once you're on the intensive care unit, it is not your call, usually, what happens to you. So I think decay is the one which is the challenge to us all.
Thanks very much.
I completely
did you,
agree.
Did you want to add to that?
Yeah.
Just quickly, because I think it's time.
Just when you reach my age, I think I've got a good chance of avoiding disaster and disease, but there's an inevitability about decay, and so that's stretching out in front of me. There's my son here. He's quite a long way from decay, I hope.
Thank you very much. That actually leads us very nicely into the panel we're going to be discussing, that we're going to be taking part in after the break, when we are going to actually address that very question of whether decay and death are necessary. Are they a necessary end? But it is now time for a tea break. Tea is actually not being served in this building, but in the Corpus Christi Dining Hall. I have a note here that says there will be guides. So you'll be shown where to go and get your tea. But before we leave to do that, I'd like you just to join me in thanking our three extremely interesting speakers for giving us a very entertaining time.